You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. While it's not officially over, fire season in the Pacific Northwest is coming to a close. For much of the country, the wetter-than-average summer meant fewer fires in places that typically burn, but dry conditions fueled the second-worst Northwest fire season on record. Conrad Wilson reports.
On August 6th, the fast-moving Rowena fire burned out of control on the Oregon side of the Columbia River Gorge. Craig Tomasian anxiously watched as fire crews worked to protect his home.
Fire has been burning all around it throughout the morning and the afternoon, and the air assets have been amazing with pinpoint drops on the surrounding scrub oak. So, yep, it's been pretty intense.
Tomasian and many of his neighbors were evacuated. They didn't know if their homes would be saved.
It's not out of the woods yet, but you know, there's nothing you can really do.
Whether through the efforts of firefighters, a break in the winds, or just by chance, Tomasian's home didn't burn. Others in the Northwest weren't so lucky. The Rowena fire was one of more than 3,200 fires that broke out in the region this year. So far, states and the feds have spent more than $446 million to put out fires in the region, according to the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center. Last year, firefighting costs were closer to $235 million. According to the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, some 1.2 million acres burned in Oregon and Washington.
That's almost half of the total acres in the country this year.
Ed Delgado is the National Program Manager for Predictive Services at the agency. He says for most of the country, it was a quiet fire season.
Washington, Oregon, and Northern California have had pretty active years, and most of that was compressed into the 6 weeks from mid-July to the end of August.
For more than 43 days in a row, the Northwest was the country's top firefighting priority, according to the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center. Carol Conley is the fire information officer at the Portland-based center. She says at the fire season's peak, some 12,000 firefighters were working 900,000 acres.
What that meant really was we had the most resources, the most complexity. It isn't always about how many fires you have, but the threat to life and property of those fires.
She says it was because of the slow fire season elsewhere that the Northwest was able to get all the resources it needed. She says firefighters and equipment could have been stretched even thinner if more western states had active fire seasons. In Oregon, the largest fire was the Buzzard Complex. It started in mid-July and burned nearly 400,000 acres in the eastern part of the state near Burns. Conley says in Washington, the Carlton Complex fire burned more than 250,000 acres and destroyed more than 320 homes, becoming the largest fire in the state's recorded history.
After that, there was, you know, they had floods, they had all sorts of problems. It was a devastating fire for many, many areas up in that Okanagan Valley.
While September brought some new fires, Delgado says the fire season is coming to a fast close.
That's what we're seeing right now. We're getting this cool weather, bringing in rain, and that's going to really, it's going to be hard for those conditions to get back to where the fuels are receptive to fire again. So even if you do get another lightning outbreak, you might get some more fire starts, but they're not going to get really big.
I'm glad it's over.
Conley says the only year worse than this was in 2012 when 1.5 million acres in the Northwest burned.
It was a very long, challenging year for firefighters and for fire managers. It tested our abilities.
Conley cautions that just because a lot of acres burned in the region this year doesn't mean it couldn't happen again next year. I'm Conrad Wilson in Vancouver, Washington.
Legal marijuana has been for sale since July in Washington, but the debate over how much marijuana someone can consume before they're considered legally impaired continues. Steve Jackson has more.
The legal limit for the active ingredient of marijuana, THC, before someone is considered too impaired to drive, is 5 nanograms per milliliter of blood. That standard was crafted into the state law based on a limited body of scientific study on the topic. The standard is based on active THC rather than the THC that can build up in someone's fatty tissues and be detected weeks after someone has ingested marijuana. But the debate over whether that standard is too high or too low continues. Spokane County Sheriff Ozzie Knezovich says in his discussion with the state patrol, he's learned that no one pulled over for impaired driving so far has tested above that 5 nanogram level.
The highest level that I've heard of through the discussions on this topic is 3.8. And the trooper that told that number to us said that this individual was, quote, baked. I mean, just very, very impaired. So our concern is you've set a level at 5 as your per se, and we've never seen anybody at 5 yet.
But ACLU attorney Allison Holcomb, who crafted the initiative that legalized marijuana, says there is also concern that the standard could be too low.
But we will be watching very carefully, because what we would be concerned about is whether or not any unimpaired drivers were getting caught up in the system. From the ACLU perspective, what we see is that here in the state of Washington, we have a very strong state constitution. We have much stronger restrictions on when law enforcement can stop people on suspicion of driving. There has to be probable cause of impaired driving before you can be taken in to have a blood test in the first place. So we don't really see this per se standard as changing officer behavior in the field very much.
There's some discussion that medical marijuana patients or others who use a large amount of cannabis regularly do not become as impaired as the occasional user because they're accustomed to its effects. Chris Marr of the Liquor Control Board says more research on the topic needs to be done by an objective third party.
And we have one of the premier medical research institutions in the state, the University of Washington, to bring them into this discussion so they can appropriately survey the empirical evidence out there and conduct some of their own studies, because right now we're kind of dealing with anecdotal or unverified evidence.
That impairment standard could be changed. Initiative 502 is written as a living document, and the legislature can make changes to specifics of the law. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Oregonians will decide this fall whether to legalize recreational marijuana. Measure 91 would allow adults in Oregon to grow, possess, and sell marijuana under state regulation. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
I've come to this crowded Portland brew pub to find people who want to legalize recreational marijuana in Oregon. It's a campaign party held by the group behind Measure 91. But there's no one smoking pot here, at least not inside. You can't legally smoke anything in Oregon restaurants, much less weed. But it's not hard to find people who fess up to enjoying a joint now and then. People like Travis Hackett.
I've used it for a long time. I've known a lot of people who've used it for a long time. I've known very few people who've ever run into any problems while using it, other than legal issues.
Now, those legal issues might make some people think twice about speaking to a reporter about their marijuana use. But pot activists clearly see a new era on the horizon. Portlander Russ Belville hosts a daily online marijuana talk show. He compares the growing acceptance of marijuana to the growing acceptance of gay marriage.
We've been forced to be in a smoky closet, if you will, hiding who we are. And now, as more and more people have become medical marijuana patients or upfront recreational users, there's less stigma, there's less fear of the unknown.
Belville says it's a far cry from when he first started advocating for marijuana legalization back in the 80s.
There was nowhere to talk about this, and if you broach the question that you were suspected of being a criminal, you're interested in the marijuana question, why is that? And you're inviting, you know, scrutiny into your own personal habits.
Belville and other Measure 91 supporters say marijuana should be taxed and regulated in much the same way as alcohol is in Oregon. They say it would bring in millions of dollars in new revenue to the state and would provide oversight to a product that is widely used already. Oregon would join Washington and Colorado in legalizing pot if the initiative passes. Supporters say there's a groundswell nationally to ease laws on marijuana and that it's only a matter of time. For now, though, without a medical reason, it's still a crime to light up. So when I asked Belville what I'd seen him enjoying on the sidewalk before our interview, he said,
I'm afraid the Fifth Amendment applies in this case. Thanks.
Another person I spoke to freely admitted to smoking weed, just not recently, and definitely not at the pro-legalization party. Josh Marquis is the district attorney of Clatsop County, Oregon. I caught up with him after a debate of Measure 91 at the Salem City Club. He's long been one of the state's leading voices against recreational marijuana use. And he says he used marijuana back in his college days.
What I remember is within about 20 seconds of taking a hit, I felt it right then and there. It's not like taking a couple beers or a couple glasses of wine and feeling slightly relaxed. You are immediately in a fairly, you can tell when you're stoned.
Marquis says the legalization crowd is understating the risks of using marijuana. And he says Measure 91 in particular is way too cavalier. For instance, if the initiative passes, adults could have up to a half pound of marijuana at home.
That is a lot of marijuana.
In fact, it's 8 times as much as the law allows in Washington. And it would remain illegal under federal law even if the measure passes. Marquis says he's also concerned about the potential for many more drivers to hit the road under the influence of marijuana. That's something he already sees as a prosecutor.
Now, is it as big a deal as using heroin or oxycodone or something like that? No, it's not. But it's not entirely benign or without risk.
Oregon voters rejected a marijuana legalization measure 2 years ago. Backers of this effort say the new measure is written to address concerns raised by opponents the first time around over regulation issues. Oregon was the first state to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. That happened back in 1973. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, of the more than $7 million raised so far by the Background Checks for Gun Sales Initiative 594 in Washington State, more than half has come from individuals who gave $50,000 or more.
Some billionaires in Washington State have decided to dump a ton of money into this I-594, this gun control initiative.
I know. It's billionaires are trying to bully us around.
Austin Jenkins reports on who those top donors are, plus Chris Lehman reports on the campaigns of Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley and challenger Republican Monica Webby. Those stories coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Sunshine and clouds mixed today. Highs in the high 60s with northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tonight, partly cloudy skies, overnight lows in the low 50s. One of Oregon's two Senate seats is up for grabs this election season. The front runners are incumbent Democrat Jeff Merkley and Republican Monica Webby. The two campaigns have been steadily volleying attacks at one another, most recently about who is willing to debate the other and in what venue and at what time. Christian Foden-Wenzel talked to each of the candidates and some of their supporters and has this report.
On a recent Saturday morning in Portland, Jeff Merkley met with volunteers at one of his offices. Retiree Carol Alder was there to show her support.
I just think he's terrific, and I've been volunteering a bit here, and I had a house party for him over at where I live, which is Mirabella. You know Mirabella?
Mirabella is a retired community in a high-rise in Portland. 25 miles south at the Clackamas County Fair, Monica Webby is shaking hands with people when 26-year-old Kevin Moss hands her a campaign donation.
She's genuine. You look in her eyes and you can see the sincerity, that she cares. Very few politicians, if any, can do that.
While they both might enjoy the kudos on the campaign trail, Webby and Merkley are two very different candidates. They have separate views on business, international trade, and the role of government. What exactly Webby wants to do became a little fuzzy after news organizations pointed out she had copied large portions of her website from Karl Rove and other Republicans. In response, her campaign pulled down the issues section of her site. What we do know is that Webby is the director of pediatric neurosurgery at Randall Children's Hospital. She says she's running to help small businesses, among others.
Uncertainty about government regulation, government interference in their business, what taxes are there going to be, how are they going to change, all sorts of issues that are going on that are making it difficult for our business owners to continue to grow their practices and allow them to hire people.
According to her website, Webby is endorsed by the National Federation of Independent Business and the National Rifle Association. She's also raised more than $2 million. Jeff Merkley has raised almost $7 million. His website says he has the endorsement of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare and the American Federation of Teachers. Like Webby, Merkley says he also has problems with government interference in business. But for him, that interference revolves around the loss of family wage jobs and corporate tax subsidies.
We have been offshoring those jobs through subsidies. That is illogical to subsidize your competition overseas. We have to end that. We need to increase our investment in education. These things that are going to pay off and enable families to thrive.
What Webby and Merkley can agree on is the need to reduce the federal deficit. She lays the blame for it at the feet of Democrats and Oregon's incumbent senator.
You know, Senator Merkley believes that the answer to everything is bigger government, more government control, more regulations.
But Merkley says that's not how he sees things.
This deficit is a direct result of the Bush administration policies that blew up the economy. I'm determined that we eliminate it, go back to the end equivalent of the Clinton administration when we were running a surplus. Under the last 5 years, we've cut the deficit to roughly a third, about 35% of its peak.
So far, much of the campaign debate has centered on outside money, and in particular, funding for ads like this.
We work hard. We deserve leaders who work just as hard for us. But Senator Jeff Merkley? In 6 years, Merkley wrote only one bill that became law.
That's an ad released by the Freedom Partners Action Fund. Merkley talks a lot about the group's ties to the conservative Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers' values are absolutely the opposite of our Oregon values. Now, they have laid out an agenda. She signed on to 8 items in their agenda. She's done so in writing, but these are not values that serve us well.
Here's Webby's response.
We can't control who comes into the races, you know, what super PACs get involved. We have no communication with these people.
In answer to the ads, Merkley says he's authored numerous pieces of legislation that have become law, including the Volcker Rule, which banned certain banks from making big bets, and the Water Infrastructure Financing and Innovation Act to help communities fund water repairs. He also points to his efforts to change mortgage laws and predatory lending practices. For her part, Webby says her experience as a physician makes her uniquely suited to deal with changes to the healthcare system. She's been a staunch critic of the Affordable Care Act. In addition to Webby and Merkley, there are 3 other candidates listed on November's ballot. James Leuenberger with the Constitution Party, Christina Lugo with the Pacific Green Party, and Mike Montichalin of the Libertarian Party, none of whom have reported any activity with the Federal Election Commission.
I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
So far this year, business interests have contributed more than $16 million to political campaigns and committees in Washington, but gifts from individual donors eclipse even that. That's because a small group of wealthy people are writing the largest checks. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on these large dollar donors.
If there's one person who's synonymous this year with mega campaign contributions in Washington, it's Seattle's Nick Hanauer.
I have a broad perspective on capitalism and business, and I've been rewarded obscenely for that.
This is the billionaire venture capitalist describing his wealth in a TED Talk.
Multiple homes, a yacht, my own plane, etc., etc., etc.
Hanauer has emerged as a national advocate for a higher minimum wage. But this year, he's also waging another battle, this one for passage of a gun control measure on Washington's fall ballot.
Our background check law has stopped over 40,000
people. That's a clip from a TV ad for Initiative 594. The measure would expand Washington's background check requirement for gun sales to include transactions between private parties. Right now, only federally licensed firearms dealers have to conduct a check. Just last month, Hanauer contributed $1 million to the I-594 campaign. In a phone interview with me earlier this year, Hanauer made it clear he's doing more than just underwriting the effort.
The gun fight is something that I'm not tangentially interested in. The gun fight is something I'm leading. in the state.
Hanauer is one of several wealthy Washingtonians who have written large checks to I-594. Other major donors include Bill and Melinda Gates, who together also gave $1 million, former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer and his wife Connie, who've contributed more than $800,000, and Seahawks owner and Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, who gave $500,000. Gun rights advocates have seized on the big contributions.
Right now, I want to welcome to the program the 30 Cal Gal.
Here's a recent exchange between champion shooter Annette Wachter of Seattle and NRA radio host Cam Edwards.
But some billionaires in Washington State have decided to dump a ton of money into this I-594, this gun control initiative.
I know. Billionaires are trying to bully us around.
The I-594 campaign points out it's received thousands of small donations, too. But consider this. Of the more than $7 million raised so far by Initiative 594, more than half has come from individuals who gave $50,000 or more. A gun rights measure is also on Washington's fall ballot, but so far that campaign has not reported any large contributions from individuals. When it comes to initiatives, donors can give as much as they want. There are no caps. Peter Quist is with the National Institute on Money and State Politics in Helena, Montana. He says the theory is you can't corrupt an initiative.
The idea that there are unlimited contributions there don't raise the same question about the quid pro quo opportunity that you might get with the candidate.
In Washington, direct contributions to candidates are capped, the result of a 1992 citizen initiative. But wealthy donors have other options. There are no caps on contributions to political action committees. And then there's what's been called the rich guy loophole. Individuals can give unlimited amounts to Washington's political parties and also to legislative caucus campaign committees. Peter Quist says large checks into these coffers do have quid pro quo potential.
Well, certainly any source of money that is sizable raises the question of outsized influence or access to the agenda of that candidate or that committee.
So who's writing big checks this year to PACs and legislative caucus committees? Here are just two examples of top donors.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Brent McKinley.
Brent McKinley runs a company that leases office space to the state. That's why he testified last year before a panel of lawmakers. This year, he and his wife have contributed $30,000 to a political action committee associated with Washington Senate Republicans. Control of the state Senate is on the line this November. In the past, the couple has given to both parties. Legislative Democrats have taken in $100,000 from Tom and Sonia Campion. Tom is the founder of Zumiez Clothing and a wilderness advocate.
I actually took my company public.
Here he is in a video talking about why he wanted to maximize the value of Zumiez.
To give my share of the wealth, a high percentage of it goes into protection of these great public spaces.
The Campions have a quote on their foundation website. If you aren't participating fully in the democratic process, you're leaving leverage on the table. Most deep-pocketed donors prefer to let their money do the talking. I reached out to several of these higher-dollar donors.
Hi, this is Austin Jenkins with Public Radio. I noticed that he gave a generous check to the... Wanted to put in a request to talk to Paul Allen about his political giving.
I left several voicemails and spoke to several executive assistants, but no one called me back. I did get a couple of emailed responses along the lines of, "Thanks, but no thanks." One donor said he preferred to remain out of the spotlight to avoid being hit up for additional contributions. Peter Quist of Money and State Politics says individual donors typically contribute for one of three reasons. They want to help elect their party to power, they're seeking a specific policy outcome, or they're
looking for a broader political personal utopia, I guess, if you will, rather than a specific return on their investment, necessarily.
Usually wealthy individual donors enjoy relative anonymity, but not always. This year, the Conservative Freedom Foundation called on the Thurston County Democratic Party to return a $65,000 contribution from the popular New Age teacher Jay-Z Knight. The party declined. More recently, California billionaire and climate activist Tom Steyer generated headlines. He set up a political action committee to help Democrats win back control of the Washington Senate. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.